Good morning, everyone. This is Robin Mashup, Director of Education at the Prime Center, and I will be hosting our monthly pain call entitled Spotlight on Pain Management. Today's session is inpatient pain management. I would like to introduce our presenter for today, Dr. Sanjo Pangarkar. Dr. Pangarkar is currently Director of the Inpatient and Interventional Pain Service at the West Los Angeles VA and Medical Director of the Pain Telehealth Program and Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine at UCLA. He completed his medical degree at University of Illinois, his residency at Johns Hopkins, and fellowship training in pain management at UCLA and the VA Medical Center. Dr. Pangarkar is well known for both his teaching and research in pain management. We will be holding questions for the end of the talk. At the end of the hour, there will be a feedback form to fill out immediately following today's session. Please stick around for a minute or two to complete this short form, as it is important to help us provide you with great programming. Dr. Bob Kearns, Director of the Prime Center, will be on our call today, and he will be around to take any questions related to policy at the end of our session. And now, I'm going to turn this over to our presenter.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. So I'm going to go ahead and get started. I have about 46 slides, so I'll go fairly quickly through those because I really want to leave some time to go over questions. Most of my talk is on inpatient pain, but acute pain occurs, of course, in various settings. So we can certainly talk about any questions folks may have about pain issues that occur in the clinic that need, of course, acute pain management as well. So I'll go ahead and get started. Let's see if this actually works. Okay, so my disclosure slide, in keeping with CME format, I have research grants with Medisys and Medtronic. Both of those studies are here at the VA and sadly haven't increased my personal wealth, but are hopefully leading to some good research. We'll go ahead and get started with case presentation number one. This is a patient I saw several years ago. His chief complaint was abdominal pain. So Mr. B is a 44-year-old gentleman with history of hypertension, cholesterol, and pancreatitis who was seen in the emergency room for abdominal pain. His pain was epigastric in nature. It was sharp, rated 8 out of 10, and radiating into his back. Pain increased with coughing or sneezing as well as with ingestion of food. He reports associated nausea and vomiting with pain that is constant with occasional flares. So he denied hematemesis, hematochezia, or any bright red blood per rectum. He hadn't noticed any changes in his bowel habits, nor had he drank any alcohol in the previous week. No dysuria or associated flank tenderness was noted. He had no fevers or chills, no history of nephrolithiasis. And he denied any postural hypertension or dizziness, any issues that might actually indicate other problems with his GI system. As mentioned, his past history, he had a history of high blood pressure, cholesterol, pancreatitis. He underwent an open cholecystectomy in 2003, and essentially his family history is non-contributory. He's married. He owns a small business here in Los Angeles, smokes about a pack of cigarettes per day, and denies any alcohol use. In terms of allergies, he has no known drug allergies. His medications are amlodipine, atorvastatin, ibuprofen, and his review systems is positive for abdominal pain only. In terms of his physical exam, other than being tachycardic, he really just had a little mild distress in his gut, decreased skin turgor, so a little dehydration. But otherwise, there were really no focal issues that we could see other than just tenderness in his epigastrium. His lab showed a little elevation in his amylase and lipase. His white count's elevated at 12.6. His hematocrit's a little bit low at 36. His CT of his abdomen showed peripancreatic and mesenteric fat stranding, as well as the history of the cholecystectomy. In terms of our differential, more likely than not, this is pancreatitis and a recurrence of his usual symptoms. In fact, he had 3 previous episodes of pancreatitis and had been admitted for all of those as well. But within the differential, we, of course, because this is an inpatient setting, we want to make sure we don't miss things like hepatic ulcer disease, especially because he's taking ibuprofen, nephrolithiasis, and inferior MI, AAA. Esophageal tear and rupture, those tend to be far more painful, and the patients tend to be very symptomatic, but of course, that's on the differential. And then also a potential for small bowel obstruction. In terms of his assessment, he is a 44-year-old gentleman with a history of recurrent pancreatitis and severe pain. He had significant nausea and vomiting with dehydration, which limits the amount of medications that can be given orally. So essentially, he was going to be admitted to the hospital. And what our service decided to do is place him on a PCA, or a patient-controlled analgesic regimen. And we chose Dilaudid as our drug of choice, or hydromorphone. We gave the patient a loading dose of 0.5 milligrams times 1 with a trigger dose, which means every time he hits the button for the PCA, he gets 0.2 milligrams of medication delivered. And we set our lockout at about 10 minutes. We gave no basal dose, so there was nothing continuously running. We also wrote for PRN Haldol, 1 milligram every 4 to 6 hours, as well as Benadryl, 25 milligrams every 6 hours as needed. We prefer to keep Narcan at the bedside, and this is sometimes possible in hospital, sometimes it's not, but we always write that just to see if we can keep it close at hand if a patient may be at risk for sedation or respiratory compromise. So why do we use a PCA, and you know what is it indicated for? Why do we occasionally use this versus just IM or sub-Q? Well, PCA actually is indicated for moderate to severe pain. Folks who require rapid opiate titration, so significantly painful surgeries, could warrant a PCA. Those folks with incident pain, so imagine, if you will, you're in a burn center and you have a patient who needs frequent dressing changes. So we know that those dressing changes are going to be painful, and we want to make sure that we have access to giving, you know, potent medications very, very quickly if needed. For folks with severe nausea or vomiting who can't keep food down or medications down, it's also a fairly nice means of giving good pain control. And then for folks with pain intensities that change rapidly, those things can also be very helpful. In general, we would like a patient to be in the hospital for around 48 hours. It's not necessarily a litmus test, but it takes us a little bit of time to make sure that we get the right dosing and the right frequency of medications. So if the patient is just going to be admitted for, you know, a day or less, we certainly wouldn't use a PCA, or we'd probably not use a PCA. But in folks with an admission that's probably going to be, you know, 2, 3, 4 days, we'll definitely start a PCA. So the outcomes, generally speaking, patients who are on PCAs will have better pain relief in comparison to those getting IM or sub-Q injections. They're generally happier as well. This is controversial about less drug consumption, but most people feel that if the patient understands how to use the PCA, overall they'll probably use fewer dosing intervals and fewer milligrams in total over a given hospital period. And by the very nature of a PCA, there's oftentimes less post-operative complications. The patients, when they become sedated, will generally stop using the PCA because they fall asleep. And with that, the medications aren't in the system. So as the patient begins to wake back up, they can actually hit the... Hello? I think I may have just got cut off. But anyway, I'll keep going because I think maybe somebody disconnected.
Fine.
Okay, okay. Generally speaking, giving somebody an IM or a sub-Q injection every few hours is also in itself painful. So using a PCA can be helpful in that way because it's a single IV that they probably already have in place. So who do we use a PCA on? I can probably tell you who we don't use a PCA on better than who we do. But patients who are demented or delirious generally won't do well with a PCA. They oftentimes don't have the carryover to continue using it effectively over the course of, you know, the day or the hospital stay. Obviously, patients who are comatose, patients with significant sleep apnea, whether it's obstructive or central, are also at higher risk for adverse event. But that's actually a relative contraindication. We will still use it in sleep apnea. We'll just monitor the patient more closely. Folks with poor hand function, and what that means is, we had several cases where we had patients with arthritis mutilans, and they literally didn't have the bone structure in their hand to actually squeeze the PCA button. We were able to devise something with their chin that they could use to depress the button. So that's a relative issue, just the notion that they should be able to use it themselves and not have to rely on a family member or the nursing staff. to use the device. In persons with significant language barriers, it may be an issue because they may not understand what we're telling them to do. Also, with patients with poor renal function, it may be something to just keep an eye on because over the course of time, the doses of drug may build in the system. And then lastly, patients under the age of 7 years. So it has been, PSAs have been effectively used in patients as young as 3 to 4 years old, but most young kids don't have carryover with these devices, and so we generally recommend kids who are older than, or 7 or older. The highest issue with side effect is usually nausea and vomiting associated with the use of a PCA, and that highest incidence usually occurs in the first day. Patients also complain of itching and sedation. Respiratory depression, thankfully, is the one thing all of us worry about, and the incidence is actually about 0.8% or less, so it's significantly low, and it's not something that we don't worry about because it is something we worry about, but it's not something we frequently encounter. In terms of patients with renal dysfunction, we do, again, keep a closer eye on those folks, as well as patients with hepatic dysfunction. So the drugs we use are fairly straightforward. These are drugs that all of us have heard about. When we talk to patients about these medications, of course, there's a different perception. So morphine sulfate, the pros, everyone generally has heard of morphine, so there's familiarity. The dosing is fairly straightforward. It's 1 milligram, 2 milligrams. So that in itself is fairly easy for everyone to keep a track of, and it's also relatively safe. The con side of morphine is that there is a significant amount of fear in a certain part of the population about morphine. So it seems that the older the patient is, the more they've heard about morphine and the more fear there is, and they say, no, I don't want that. But of course, we can definitely talk patients or at least discuss the risks and benefits, and most of them will agree with using a PCA, especially with morphine or something else. There is increased metabolite formation with morphine, or there's increased active metabolite, so we do keep an eye on that. There's also increased nausea, vomiting with this in comparison to some of the other drugs that we use. There's increased histamine release, itching, and also potential hypotension. The drug that I would probably use if I was admitted is hydromorphone, and some of this gets to these drugs and how they are hydrophilic or lipophilic. Hydromorphone tends to be fairly lipophilic, so it tends to cross the blood-brain barrier fairly quickly, and once it's in, it actually stays for a period of time, so it is a fairly smooth drug for pain relief, and then it sticks around long enough that you don't have to frequently dose to it. But it is more expensive, and there's lack of familiarity. But having said that, there's less nausea, vomiting, and if you use it correctly, of course, there's less adverse event. Fentanyl, many providers have familiarity with fentanyl just because we do tend to use it in the ICU setting and as well as with procedures in the outpatient surgery center. It's very fast. It's very, very lipophilic, so it gets in the system very quickly. Less nausea, vomiting, pretty safe overall, and the duration is short. So if you think about it from the perspective of somebody who may have had an outpatient colonoscopy, they'll get fentanyl as the drug administered during the colonoscopy, and generally speaking, that patient is discharged later that day, and they don't have really the hangover effect that some of the other drugs have. The problem with fentanyl is that it does have an exceptionally short half-life, and so in PCA dosing, there's a frequent amount of triggering that the patient has to do to keep up with what they need. It's also very expensive, and so we tend not to use it as much, not just because of expense, but because it's more work for the patient in the long run. There are still folks using Demerol or Meperidine in their PCA. It's not very common. Our GI service tends to request this more than any other service, and there's a thought that there's less biliary tract spasm associated with Meperidine than with others. It is fairly quick in onset, again, has less nausea and vomiting. The problem with it, of course, is there is a abuse potential. There's this potential for seizures as well, and overall, Meperidine is a fairly low-potency opioid, and it has some of the flavors that we generally don't like about an opiate, meaning it has a high euphoric effect, it has low potency, and it has a lot of risks associated with it. So we tend to avoid using this in a PCA. Occasionally we will use it in the inpatient setting, but not very commonly. So the best way to dose a PCA is usually through the patient's age. Nobody really uses that because it's tough to figure out exactly based on an age how much to give. So we generally use weight, and obviously I'll show you on the next slide what I mean, but age is actually better for the simple reason that with age, excretion, metabolism, and drug distribution begins to change fairly, not rapidly, but enough such that we worry. In terms of morphine as an example, the loading dose that we give, so imagine, if you will, our patient, Mr. B, who's 44, comes into the ER and we want to give him something rapidly to give him pain control so that he can be comfortable. So we dose this based on 0.04 milligrams per kilogram of lean body weight. So in a 70 kilogram patient, sorry, my slides are a little off. In a 70 kilogram patient, if we multiply that by 0.04 milligrams per kilogram, we get around 2.8 milligrams. So giving somebody 3 milligrams of IV push morphine may help reduce pain, and also is about 9 milligrams of oral morphine equivalent. So they're getting around 10 milligrams when they come to the ER, and then we set up the PCA so that there's a trigger dose. That trigger dose is based on 0.02 milligrams per kilogram of lean body weight. So a 70 kilo patient will get about 1 milligram or even maybe 1.5 milligrams per trigger dose. And then we'll set the lockout interval at a 10-minute interval. You can set the lockout interval to anything, and all that essentially means is the patient is locked out from pushing the button, or at least they can push the button, but it doesn't deliver a drug bolus to the patient. And so we can control how much a patient generally will get based on their lockout interval. So I tend to use 6 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and the reason is it's easily divisible by or into 60. So I can know exactly how much a patient is getting. So if I set a 10-minute lockout interval like I did in this patient, then maximally every time he triggers it, he gets 1 milligram. So the most he's going to get in a given hour is 6 milligrams of morphine. So it's very similar to how we would do hydromorphone, but the dosing changes a little. It's 8 micrograms per kilogram of lean body weight. So in a 70-kilogram patient, we're talking about 0.5 or 0.6 milligrams of a loading dose, which is, again, about 10 milligrams of morphine equivalent, oral morphine equivalent, just to keep that in perspective. And then the trigger dose we set at 4 milligrams or micrograms per kilogram of lean body weight. And so that's going to be, generally speaking, 0.2 to 0.3 milligrams of a trigger dose. And that's probably what many of you have seen in the hospital setting, is we start Dilaudid at 0.2 milligrams with a lockout interval of every 10 minutes. And so, again, they get, you know, about 1.2 milligrams in an hour. And that's around 20 milligrams of morphine equivalent, oral morphine equivalent, in a given hour, just to give you an idea of what that actually entails. Other concepts, the notion of lean body weight. Lean body weight is just basically your body weight minus your fat body weight. And so we don't really think about this too much, but it is something to keep in mind. In terms of side effects, one of the biggest concerns that any provider has is the issue of respiratory depression. And so Narcan comes in a 0.4 milligram ampule. These are generally available in the hospital setting, in any Pyxis, and certainly in the crash cart. But they work fairly quickly, within 2 to 3 minutes, and they will stay in the system for about an hour. If you do have a patient who has respiratory depression, meaning they're breathing, you know, they say they're breathing less than 8 times a minute, and they don't seem very responsive, we would definitely monitor that patient fairly closely, and then probably stop their PCA. One of the nice things about the new PCA systems that are available, there's a capnography monitor within the PCA. I'm not sure if all VAs have this, but we have this here at West LA. But one of the nice things about the capnography monitor, which monitors carbon dioxide basically, is as that level is triggered in the machine, in the PCA machine, it stops the PCA from working. So again, as patients' risks go up for respiratory depression, the machine itself will begin to turn off. so that they can't administer any more doses, which might obviously increase their risk for further problems. Anyway, so we actually will start an IV drip of Narcan if needed, if a patient does have respiratory compromise to the point where we need to move them into the ICU. What I tend to do if a patient is just light, you know, is looking a little bit sedated but otherwise stable in terms of their vital signs, is just load 0.4 milligrams of Narcan into a 10cc syringe, and then just, you know, administer 1cc aliquots until the patient wakes up. It's not as violent as giving them the whole 0.4 milligram ampule at one time, which will definitely, in a code situation, of course, that's what you do, but in a situation where the patient's vital signs are stable, you can actually slowly bring them back into consciousness. Other issues that will inevitably arise with the use of opiates, whether given orally or IV, is constipation. So starting a stool softener and a laxative is helpful. For itching, Benadryl can be very effective, 25 milligrams IV or PO. In terms of nausea or vomiting, metoclopramide or Haldol or haloperidol can be given as well, both of which are very effective. We tend not to use very many basal PCAs, and a basal PCA is essentially a PCA that's a continuous infusion of the opiate into the system. You can have a basal as well as a trigger dose, so that the patient may be receiving, say, in terms of morphine, maybe they're getting 1 or 2 milligrams of a basal continuously per hour, but they can still use the trigger dose. And the notion is that it would give folks who are on chronic opiates a baseline of medication throughout the day so they don't go into withdrawal. But then the trigger dose would also help with any acute or incident pain they may be experiencing. So there is some value to it. For some patients, it can allow them to sleep through the night. It can actually help with especially painful surgery so that the patient doesn't fall asleep and then get nothing for a period of time and then wake up in agony. So it can be helpful in those situations. The problem with a basal PCA is that it removes the intrinsic safety of a PCA, meaning the patient who's receiving a basal may be getting sedated, but unlike a trigger dose, once you become sedated, you generally don't trigger the PCA to give you more medication. You just fall asleep. And with a basal, that continuous infusion is in the system and may cause further and further compromise. And so it does cause some problems. We generally don't recommend it for most patients who are opiate naive. And for most studies indicate that the amount that's given over 24 hours is about the same whether you use a basal or not. And so I don't think it necessarily adds that much, except for a very small percentage of the population that we treat. This is just, as I mentioned before, so basal PCA pros, some patients sleep better through the night because of it. There's lower effort-dependent pain score, so they don't have to keep triggering the system. Can be especially effective in thoracic, GI, and pelvic surgery, so any surgery where the abdomen and the chest are constantly required to move, which can be in itself very, very painful after surgery. And then it's useful in patients on chronic opioid therapy. So if a patient already is on, say, 90 milligrams of morphine before they come to the hospital for a chronic pain condition, you can match that in the basal so that they receive at least 90 milligrams to keep them out of withdrawal. These patients are usually opiate tolerant to a certain degree, so they may need more medication to begin with, and that's one of the ways we address it. We did discuss the cons already, so I'll just skip that slide. When somebody is getting ready to leave the hospital, we kind of work with the surgical service so that we know that about 24 hours in advance, and what we'll do is switch over the medications to an oral agent at least 24 hours before they are discharged so we can actually adjust even more. So we convert the PCA dose to the oral dose through the equal analgesic charts that are available. We will generally reduce it because you'll see that these numbers are staggering when you see what the patient may have actually used during the inpatient stay. So we'll generally reduce it significantly. In terms of other ways to reduce it, we can add a little Tylenol for dose reduction of the PCA itself. We don't stop the PCA until we've given the first dose of oral medication for about 90 minutes if it's a short-acting. So imagine, if you will, the patient's getting 10 milligrams of oxycodone orally. So we'll wait for about an hour, hour and a half before we turn off the PCA so we know that the drug is now in the system and that they're not going to be left without anything so that they're in pain. And then if you're going to use a long-acting medication, so somebody may be getting morphine sulfate sustained release, we'll usually turn off the PCA after about 6 hours after they receive their first dose, because we know at that point that they're actually hitting steady state. So this brings me to case number two, and so we'll go through the cases, which will be hopefully more interesting than going through the just the semantics of dose and drug selection. So this is a patient who comes in with hip pain. He also comes to the emergency room. He's 76 years old. He has a history of high blood pressure and diabetes, also a history of prostate cancer, and has a pathologic fracture of his right hip. His creatinine is 1.8. So how would you manage his pain? This is his fracture, so fairly significant fracture. Fractures are painful. PCA can be helpful, especially with a loading dose, to get that patient up to comfort as fast as we can give them comfort safely. The medication chosen should be safe for patients with impaired renal or hepatic function. This patient's creatinine was 1.8. Adjuvant therapies from different drug classes can be helpful. So we do use muscle relaxants. We use anti-inflammatories. We use things like gabapentin routinely to reduce our total amount of opiates needed. The route of medication should keep in mind the upcoming surgery and potential NPO status. So the patient is going to surgery within the next day. You may want to make sure that you're not giving them aspirin or increasing their risk or an anti-inflammatory that might increase their bleeding risk in any way, as well as compromise the NPO status. And then with cancer-related issues, the best thing generally is to get the oncologist on board or the radiation oncology medicine. So there are other things we can use besides just medications to help with pain, and radiation happens to be one of those. Calcitonin can be also given intranasally. Usually we use it 200 units or 200 international units with alternating nostrils, but daily use to reduce some of the bony pain associated with cancer-related fractures. So keep in mind that the amount of opiate the patient was on prior to admission. So knowing this patient was probably on pain medications, we want to make sure that we meet those needs at least. Our surgical team oftentimes we have residents who rotate through, and it seems like the mantra is always, you know, whenever the patient's on oral medications, Vicodin 1 to 2 tabs, you know, Q4 to 6 hours PR in pain, which can work in a lot of patients, but it's just really not an effective way of treating patients. So we just say keep in mind what the patient was on prior to coming in so that we can at least meet those needs. That amount may serve as a basal if kidneys and liver are okay. In this patient, choosing Dilaudid or fentanyl may actually be appropriate. And then after surgery, then consider oxycodone or Dilaudid as a possibility. You could also continue to use fentanyl as a patch because of his compromised renal function. With his age, I probably wouldn't use methadone, though that also doesn't have active metabolites. In terms of case presentation three, this is a 43-year-old woman who presents with severe low back pain. She has a history of depression and rheumatoid arthritis and developed severe back pain, fairly sudden in onset. She had lower extremity weakness, and her MRI showed a L3 osteomyelitis with discitis. So the questions I have, how would you manage this patient's pain as an inpatient? Would you consider adding a long-acting medication? What would you use as an adjuvant? And then what happens if the pain reports rise during treatment, meaning they're actually getting pain medications already, but they continue to complain of pain? So this is the L3 problem that she has, and you can see that the vertebral body is actually going, or the discitis and osteomyelitis is actually going into the canal and compromising the canal to the point where she's having weakness in her legs. So first decide if surgery is planned. If surgery is planned, then consider a PCA, and that just allows her to have effective pain control without having to take anything by mouth. If surgery isn't planned and the patient is just going to be managed medically, then starting off with a very potent short-acting opiate, whether that be morphine or oxycodone or even Dilaudid, doesn't really matter. The idea is just to find the right dose for her and the right drug for her so that she can actually have effective pain relief. Once we've established that she's on a stable regimen and we know the milligram percentage, we can switch that over to a long-acting if we need to. But we tend to avoid combination agents, things like Vicodin, things like Percocet, and the reason for that is specifically that the acetaminophen itself becomes a limiting dose, so you can't give over a certain amount of drug because the acetaminophen acts as a problem for the liver, for the patient. So we tend to use pure drugs in those situations like oxycodone or Dilaudid. So patients do not need to be started on long acting. Yeah, I just mentioned that. So even if therapy is planned for some time, keeping them on a short acting potent medication and then switching them over when they're stable is perfectly reasonable. Once the patient is on a stable regimen, then you can go ahead and switch over to a long acting, depending on how long that treatment will be. Many times with discitis osteomyelitis, the patient is in for 6 weeks of antibiotic treatment. And so you know that for 6 weeks they're going to require, something. And so in those situations we can switch over to a long acting, with maybe some short acting as breakthrough. We want to actually choose a long-acting that may have some neuropathic pain. This is a woman who had compromise of her spinal canal. So she has nerve-related pain, and she also has nociceptive pain or tissue pain. So using something like methadone or levorphanol can be helpful. Both of those have NMDA antagonism associated with them, so they can be helpful for nerve pain in and of themselves, not just because they're very potent opiates. But other agents like morphine, OxyContin, fentanyl, Dilaudid, hydromorphone even comes in a long-acting now. So these are all available as long-actings, and we can certainly choose based on their risk profile and how the patient's responded to them in the past. Using adjuvants such as neuropathic pain medications like anti-epileptics, antidepressants, these are usually in the things like gabapentin, Lyrica, or pregabalin, amitriptyline, et cetera. So nociceptive pain meds can also be used, so things like muscle relaxants and for bony pain, anti-inflammatories like NSAIDs. Generally, precautions are if you're going to use things like methadone, then get an EKG beforehand. Make sure that the patient has appropriate renal function and liver function. There are some data to suggest that in patients with spine surgery, that use of an anti-inflammatory like an NSAID can contribute to a non-union rate, so where the bones don't actually heal correctly. So just make sure with your surgeon beforehand what he or she believes philosophically and whether or not to use those drugs. But there is some data. I'm not sure if anyone believes that data, but it is out there. Check SAID rates and CRPs periodically. Remember, this is a patient who actually was doing pretty well before her injury, and then suddenly had this compromise. So if she's telling you she has increasing pain, she probably does. And that may indicate that we're not getting the right medicine to her or the right frequency, but it may also indicate that the patient is getting worse despite antibiotics. So if, in fact, the tissue itself is becoming more involved or the antibiotics aren't correctly fixing her problem, then a SAID rate and a CRP can give you some sort of guideline that if it's going up, then things aren't what they should be, and we might need to reassess her pain issue rather than just going up on our medications. Last thing to worry about is sometimes selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac and Paxil may alter the cytochrome P450 system, so specifically the 2D6 pathway. And so you can sometimes reduce the effect of pain medications, and so just be careful with that. So the last case I have is case presentation number 4. It's a 32-year-old gentleman who presents with a history of bipolar disorder and polysubstance abuse. He has a history of alcohol and heroin as his chief drugs of choice, and he's admitted for multiple fractures after being hit by a bus while intoxicated. So he walked out in front of a bus by accident very close to the VA and was actually taken initially to UCLA and then brought to the VA afterward. Anyway, he has pains, severe pain in his leg and his back that radiates down into his legs. The CT scan of his body shows a tibia and fibula fracture with bilateral fractures. Sorry, bilateral tibia fibula fractures and a fracture of L1. In terms of knowing his history, you know, how would you treat this patient? And then also, you know, what about his recent history of alcohol and cocaine abuse? So this is his imaging studies. You can sort of see that the L1 is fractured and coming into the canal a little bit. This is just a cartoon showing what a compression fracture looks like. This is more of a traumatic fracture, but this is, you can see that it's a comminuted fracture, so it's actually breaking up into pieces. And then the image on the right is a tib-fib fracture. He had that bilaterally, just from the way he was hit by the bus. So despite history, patients with acute pain should be treated. Sometimes we get frustrated because we think, man, this guy did this, you know, this to himself, and, you know, but you have to put all that aside. You have to sort of just treat them for what happened to them and trust that what they're telling you is accurate. So especially with addiction and psychosocial issues needing to be addressed in many of our patients, this is not that different than what we deal with every day. Anyway, it shouldn't mean reduce pain medications, and sometimes people don't give medications because they think that the patient is just trying to get high, which sometimes that does happen, but you just have to keep in mind that if the patient's pain score is high, you want to treat it so that you can get it effectively low enough that the rest of the treatment team can do what they need to do, which is to get an accurate history. In situations like this, we tend to get psychiatry on board early. The question for us was not just whether he had depression, anxiety, and uncontrolled bipolar disorder, but more along the lines of whether he was actually trying to commit suicide, because if he was, then obviously we need to treat that as well. Patients with a history of abuse may go on to withdrawal while in-house, so keep in mind that medications that help with withdrawal symptoms can and should be prescribed at least on a PRN basis. We tend to use a few benzos. Occasionally we use benzos, but we also use a lot of baclofen and some clonidine to help smooth out vasomotor symptoms that patients may find. So patients with a history of abuse are often tolerant and may require significantly higher doses than non-abusers, so you have to just keep that in mind. When you see the doses, and sometimes you calculate them to the oral morphine equivalent, you think, my God, you know, I'm going to kill this guy with the medicines I'm giving. And so the reality is most of these folks have seen much, much higher doses in an uncontrolled setting. At least in the controlled setting of a hospital, you can actually safely give medications and then monitor them very, very closely. Getting addiction medicine, if that is possible in the hospital, on board is helpful. You know, I generally don't initiate methadone in these patients for addiction. First of all, my license doesn't allow it. You have to be an addictionologist to write for methadone. But a lot of folks make a lot of providers make this leap of faith, and they say, well, he is an addict and he needs to be on methadone. Therefore, I'm going to go ahead and initiate methadone, start it off as a pain medication in the hospital, and then I'll send the patient off into the community where they can be enrolled into a methadone program. It just doesn't really work that way. So I keep the two things separate. I treat them in the inpatient setting for their pain with potent pain medications. If methadone is needed, I will use it, of course, but generally my goal is just to manage their acute issues and then also get addiction involved or on board either during their hospitalization or afterward if I can. So if the patient is on methadone already, you know, realize pain half-life and drug half-life are different. So methadone may stay in the system for up to 24 hours or longer. You know, there's data that suggests it stays in the system for up to 3 days, maybe longer than that even. But the pain effect is only about 6 to 8 hours. And so in a very tolerant patient, it may be even a little bit less than 6 hours. So just keep that in mind that if they're saying they have pain, it probably is true. Avoid any IV breakthrough medications once the patient is clinically stable. The reason is in patients with addiction or a history of addiction, you want to avoid that peak trough effect, that euphoric effect, because it really can cause problems for you. And then the patient may actually get triggered to relapse. Or that's a possibility, of course. So rational polypharmacy is reasonable. We always try to use the least amount of medication we possibly can in patients. But in these situations where we can use a little bit of different agents to get what we need and also to reduce the overall requirement of opiates, I think is important. So in this patient, consider a PCA. After surgery, rapidly titrate to a long or short-acting medication. Add adjuvants as needed, and then avoid NSAIDs and IV breakthrough medications if possible. The NSAIDs, because in long bone fractures, there's also indication that the use of NSAIDs may actually delay healing of bone. And again, you should just check with your orthopedic surgeon to see whether or not he or she believes that, and then treat accordingly. So in terms of overall things just to talk about with the FDA and to change subjects a little bit, as many of you have seen, all of the combination drugs, the acetaminophen has been essentially lowered in the combination drugs. So hydrocodone acetaminophen has now changed to Schedule 2 and will require in-person visit or some evaluation before just writing for it, so to bring these patients in so that we don't prescribe inappropriately. and then shorter duration between visits if opiates are prescribed. So in the patient that we mentioned, the very last gentleman who actually was injured by being hit by a bus, I'd probably want to see this guy every week, especially with his history, to make sure that he's not going down the wrong road. This is a lot of just wording. Don't worry about this part. I think I'm just going to switch to the next slide. So in clinical practice, if you are managing these types of patients, if planning on initiating opiates for these patients even after their inpatient stay, please document why you're doing that. So you could say just simply the patient recently was hospitalized for acute pain and now continues to require this medication. We will, you know, attempt to transition him to another medication. But for now, and because of uncontrolled pain, we will continue to use this medicine. Just to give everybody an idea of why the patient is continuing on medicines, and so that it's not continuing, you know, indefinitely. So establish an informed consent. I think that's one of the guidelines that we're trying to promote, that all patients have an informed consent. Check random urine toxicology screens after their discharge because, you know, many of our patients do get into trouble. And if there is any abuse or diversion suspected or misuse suspected, then consider a referral to your addictionologist if that's available to you. Avoid dose escalation without examination. Obviously, that seems self-explanatory, but a lot of times patients do call and say, you know what, I twisted my ankle yesterday. Can I get a little bit more? And so I'd want to make sure that I saw the ankle was a little bit swollen before I went ahead and initiated increasing somebody's medications. Then avoid meds that potentiate the opiate. So benzodiazepines, we know, can cause increasing problems for patients. Avoid prescribing methadone unless very familiar with that drug, and then also check your PDMP or your state prescription monitoring program just to ensure that the patient isn't getting medicines from multiple providers, just to keep them safe. Anyway, my last slide, my summary slide, is all patients deserve good pain management. You know, pain management may include opiates as an option. Certainly in the inpatient setting, we use a lot of opiates, and effectively so, to help reduce discomfort. But we also use a lot of adjuvants to reduce the overt all dose that opiates that we give in opiates. Consider patient comorbidities when choosing a drug. So we talked about liver disease and kidney disease. Keep in mind drugs that may alter opiate metabolism, like some SSRIs that affect the 2D6 pathway, and then get consultation early if it's available to you. So that's really all I have, and certainly we have a little bit of time for questions, so if anyone has any questions, by all means.
This is a wonderful presentation. We have one question that's come in, but as other people have questions, please feel free to type them in. This first question has to do with complementary approaches. It sounds like at the Greater Los Angeles VA, there's a team of 3 RNs that are dedicated to providing things like healing touch, Reiki, comfort massage, and then they have a staff of wow, this is amazing, 100-plus who are trained in aromatherapy. There's a teeny-tiny budget they have for this, and sounds like they're losing some of their providers. They're losing a certified massage therapist. But do you have any, I guess, words of wisdom or ideas about how other VAs could tap into these kinds of resources or what your experience has been like with them?
I didn't even mention that. I should have. That's a tremendous asset to our facility, and I should have mentioned it right off the cuff. The use of healing touch in the inpatient setting is so critically important for so many of our patients who don't have a lot of support outside of the VA. And so having somebody go in and talk to them, provide a massage, provide some, you know, just some basic healing words, I think is really, really important. Funding is always important. That's how we get people and resources involved. And I'm not sure how we deal with that, but Bob is on the phone, and he's one of the main guys at the VA doing research. So as long as he hears that, I think we all need to be more proactive about using other things besides purely medications or interventions. This is actually a wonderful thing we have here at GLA, and I wish everyone else had it as well. I don't think it really answers your question.
Bob, are you out there? Do you have any comments about this?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so I Sanjar, I'd like this to take this cue to actually ask you to elaborate a little, just a little, on what you, your presentation today in the broader context of your American Pain Society Clinical Center of Excellence award-winning program more broadly at Greater LA VA. Just a snapshot, of course. I don't want to take away from questions specifically related to inpatient or acute pain management, but I do want to, maybe I'll just say to the group, Sanjak was the presenter last year at the American Pain Society when his program, which is really a broad in scope, outpatient, inpatient, CARF-accredited pain rehabilitation program, won a very prestigious award in our field, the American Pain Society Clinical Centers of Excellence Award. So, Dr. Pankajar, if you'd kind of say a little more about that before returning to the questions about acute pain management. I think that'd be great for the group to know.
Yeah. So we've broken our system down into three different arms, right? So we have the inpatient setting, we have the interventional setting, and then we have the outpatient chronic pain clinic. And so what we wanted to have, and what I think the luxury our system has, is that most of us work in all settings. So I know that whatever I may do in the inpatient setting, if I dose up somebody on opiates that are so high that my colleagues downstairs in the chronic pain clinic can't continue them or don't feel comfortable continuing them, I haven't helped anybody out. I've actually compromised my colleagues in some way, and I've also compromised the patient in some ways because he or she may not be able to get that care when they leave the hospital. So we have an integrated system, meaning that all of our providers sort of go back and forth between different setting. And with that, all of us are responsible to each other. So that's probably the first place to start, is that our system has a lot of different arms to it, but the people who man it are about the same. And so that's I think, important. The things that we thought were helpful with our program to keep it wide is that we not only have this complementary alternative arm that was just recently mentioned in-house as well as in our chronic pain clinic, so we can offer more than just pain medications, more than just injections, epidurals, that we can offer PT and yoga and Tai Chi if patients are interested, and we have that arm developing very, very rapidly. We also have this pretty cool telehealth program, which for folks, especially in California, which is such a large state, in places where patients can't travel safely to Los Angeles because of pain issues, maybe they have to travel 2 or 3 hours, having a scan echo program where we can actually discuss with the patient's primary care provider over the internet or over the telehealth monitor what is happening at, say, Santa Barbara or San Luis Obispo, Santa Maria. We can talk to them about what is happening with the patient and then treat them so that the patient doesn't have to come all the way to Los Angeles to be evaluated, because that in itself can be painful to be in a bus for 3 hours, and it really is an all-day endeavor for them. So there are things that we've done that we thought would help improve the scope of what we can offer, as well as also the way we offer that care, and that's to include the issues of complementary and alternative care, the CARF accreditation. We just wanted to make sure that pain was available throughout our system, meaning pain providers were able to and willing to actually take on any of these responsibilities, just to make sure that there is ownership. And once you have ownership of that patient, you really feel like you can do a little bit more, because other services believe that you're actually trying to help, as opposed to just in most academic centers where it seems a lot of times that patients get turfed and this is not my responsibility, this is not my patient. They are all of our patients. And so I think that's one of the things that makes our program cool, is that everyone bought in.
It's really interesting. I have some more specific questions about medications. This one has to do with the post-thoracic surgery. This person mentioned that they find it hard to control with the epidural pain drip. If it's not controlled appropriately, can a patient such as this have breakthrough pain medication?
That's a great question. So we've done two things. So we do bypass surgery here, and we have thoracic surgeons here. Epidural PCA can give patients a little better pain control. And so essentially it's giving them the PCA, but actually putting it into the epidural space. So the anesthesiologist who does the case before, if there's coordination between the surgeons and the anesthesiologist, can actually place a catheter right to the area where the surgery will be done, at least at a dermatoma level, and then administer drugs afterwards so that the patient has absolutely good pain relief. Other things that we've done here with chest tube related pain or post thoracotomy pain is we've used medications like Exparel or the liposomal bupivacaine. So we've gone to the ICU with the ultrasound and just blocked the intercostal nerves so that the whole area that was painful is now deadened. And that lasts for about 3 days. So the worst times of pain for most people, you know, is that first 3 days after surgery. So if we can get good, effective pain relief in those patients, then it's one of the things we've done. It's not FDA approved for that, but it is something that has helped our patients here at West LA.
So somebody just mentioned if you could comment on the use of systemic lidocaine. Sounds like you just touched upon it.
Yeah, so you mean meaning IV lidocaine drips?
Not sure, the way the question
yeah.
is asked,
so
but it came in while you were talking about this.
Sure, so we tend not to use lidocaine as an infusion, certainly not in the inpatient setting. We don't really use it. There are some studies that demonstrate use, and anecdotally this has been used for years. I mean, since I was a resident, we've been using IV lidocaine in certain situations. I think most of us have switched our philosophy. There are places that still do IV lidocaine. We tend to do IV ketamine, but that's as a chronic pain treatment. And so we do use that as an effective. Actually, we had two patients yesterday. One was a patient with complex regional pain syndrome, otherwise known as RSD. Actually, both of them had RSD. So, but we use it in lieu of IV lidocaine. We feel that it has a process that reverses, you know, central pain sensitization, and it's something that we'd be happy to share our protocols with if somebody is interested.
And do you ever use a lidocaine drip in an outpatient pain clinic?
We don't. Here at GLA, we don't.
Can you comment more on the use of Haldol for opioid-induced nausea, vomiting, relative to other antiemetics?
Yeah, of course. It works fairly well. it works quickly. It reduces a little bit of anxiety that's associated with surgery, associated with medications. The fact that people come into a patient's room every 5 or 6 minutes in itself can be disconcerting. So I think Haldol is a nice way of giving relief for the nausea, vomiting that I'm actually interested in, but it also has some secondary effects that might help patients dealing with a hospital setting.
Have you discussed local regional analgesia or catheter-based or single-shot local anesthetic infusion?
I didn't. I think that's a tremendous asset. If a facility has that, then absolutely. And what that question is getting to is, if we can provide effective blockade of a nerve or an area before surgery, then that area is generally insensate for a period of time, as long as the catheter is in, or if you're doing a single shot for the duration of the medication. But if we can render an area insensate for a period of time and the patient doesn't have pain, then all the normal functions of breathing, of eating, all those things can actually continue, and the patient actually may be able to be discharged a little bit early. So those are very, very effective means of giving pain relief, and certainly things that if a hospital has the ability to provide regional anesthesia, is what people call it, then they should by all means employ it, because it can reduce the overall amount of opiates used afterward.
This is a question going back to the Haldol. What is the dose that you use that's antiemetic?
Oh, I think I actually have it. Let me just go up to my slides real quick. When I actually put this together, Haldol, yeah, 1 milligram IV every 6 hours.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, I will give one horrible story. When I was an intern, I used Haldol and I think I gave 2 or 3 milligrams IV push. And that one patient, who I still will I'll probably remember for the end of my days, but he ended up getting neuroleptic malignant syndrome, which is a known complication of that drug. I've never seen it again, but every time I reach for Haldol, that guy comes across my visual field, and I think, is this what he would really want to use? But it is really a good drug, and at 1 milligram, generally, I haven't seen any bad stuff happen, and it is extremely effective.
Great. I have a couple questions about capsaicin. Can you comment on that and when and where you use it?
Yeah, of course. So did they clarify which capsaicin they were talking about? Are they talking about Quitenza, which is the 8%, or the 0.025 and 0.075%? Did they mention any of that?
Quitenza, is that it? Q-U-E-N-T-Z-A?
Yeah, Quitenza, yep.
Yep, that's it.
Mm-hmm. So Quitenza was made for shingles-related pain. So for people who had post-herpetic neuralgia related to shingles, Quitenza was used as a way of destroying, if you will, the nerve endings underneath the skin in the area that the patient was having pain, oftentimes in the thoracic area, in other areas as well. So it is effective. It has some data suggest that it lasts up to 3 months. We've been plus minus on it, so there are patients who definitely respond, and there are patients who don't. We've had patients who responded after one treatment, but then didn't respond to the second Quitenza application. So I'm not 100% sure why this occurs, but it is a fairly effective way of giving relief when nothing else seems to work. And the idea behind this is capsaicin is essentially a chili pepper based treatment. It causes release of substance P from the nerve endings and depletes the nerve from actually essentially being able to respond to future pain problems. Quitenza is 8%. It's like dropping napalm on somebody. It really is, will destroy all the nerve endings for a period of time. Those nerve endings do grow back, and so it is something that could be effective for some patients, but hasn't been effective in all.
Great. Can you talk about some of the other side effects of hydromorphone?
Sure. So almost all of these medications will have similar side effects. They'll cause nausea. They can, of course, cause vomiting, itching. The reason I mention hydromorphone as my drug of choice for myself if I ever get injured is because it actually offers good pain relief, relatively fast onset, and then it sticks around for a period of time, so I don't have to keep hitting that button to trigger my pain medication to be given. But as with all medications, it can cause constipation, it can cause itching, it can cause sedation, even hallucinations. But in terms of overall, we don't have that many drugs that we can give, but that tends to be my go-to drug, even though it is more expensive. Morphine is the cheapest, Dilaudid is intermediate, and fentanyl is the most expensive. So in a hospital-based system, morphine is what most of us choose initially because it is cheaper than anything else. But in patients who require rapid titration or good relief, then hydromorphone tends to be our next drug of choice.
Great. This is a different question, which is, do you speak with the nurses with regards to the time it takes for assessment and monitoring of the PCA devices?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the nurses do the vast majority of the hardest, the heavy lifting, if you will. They know the patient infinitely better than we do. But in our ICU setting, we actually have one of our team members actually rounding with the ICU team, so they're present with the nursing staff. We have fellows and residents and med students, so there's always somebody rounding on the patient, but we generally try and find out from the nurse how the patient is actually doing. Because what we hear from the patient may in fact not be reality. So, if the patient can't effectively use a PCA and that's why their pain complaint is really, really high, the nurse will usually know.
Mm-hmm. That's great. We've had some great questions. I don't see any more unless we have one or two pop in. Is there anything you wanted to add, Bob, to the discussion?
This is Bob. I want to take this opportunity before I jump off the call to another call I really want to thank you, Robin, and Heidi for organizing this. Of course, Dr. Bangarkar for this wonderful presentation, being responsive to the questions today. And encourage all those who are participants to follow up, I guess, with Dr. Bangarkar if you have other questions, and tune in for this cyber seminar series on a monthly basis. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much. If everybody could just hold on for another minute or two for the feedback form. Our next cyber seminar will be on Tuesday, March 3rd by Dr. Hilary Moser. It is called Admitted to the Hospital and in Chronic Pain, What is the Inpatient Care Team to Do? So it should be a nice follow-up to today's talk. We will be sending registration information out to everyone around the 15th of the month. I want to thank everyone for joining us at this HSR&D Cyber Seminar, and we hope to see you at a future session.
Great.